Hello, Dominic. Du bist in Deutschland.
Yes, I am. I don't know how to answer back. I'm working in French, Katie. This is very confusing for me.
Oh, I just figured that now you are in Berlin for 2 months, we were going to do this podcast in German every week.
Yeah, we should really, shouldn't we? I'm sure none of our listeners would leave.
We do have quite a lot of listeners in Germany, so maybe we should try it out 1 week. But what's it like? Are you kind of instantly cooler now that you live in Berlin?
Yeah. I wear my coolest outfits to leave the house, and still I feel like I got dressed in like H&M and everyone else has been going to these other shops that I don't know about.
It's okay. I'm sure some of the Berlin cool will rub off on you over the next few weeks. But what have you been up to? How's it going over there?
I've mainly just been rehearsing. That's the life of an opera singer. It's not very glamorous. You rehearse and then you go home and save your voice for the next day's rehearsal.
Oh, no.
Yay.
Well, maybe as well as doing this podcast in German, we should do it in a whisper.
No, whispering is not necessarily better for the voice, actually.
Really? I'm learning so many things in the first minute and a half of this podcast.
Hey, yeah, just you wait. How's your week been, Katie?
It's been good. I have been doing a lot of painting, actually. Now that I'm 30, I've painted one of my walls a different colour in my sitting room, because that's what you have to do when you're 30.
Oh, an accent wall. That's cool, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, I thought it was called a feature wall. I don't know what it is. Anyway, it's sort of green.
Sort of green.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know how paints are always called like weird things, like elephant's breath and stuff like that.
Yes.
I think this color green should be the color of that thing that you ate last week that you didn't know what it was. What was it called again?
Kohlrabi.
Kohlrabi, yeah. We had a lovely listener write in, by the way, Anna from Austria, who said that actually where she's from, kohlrabi's really like everyday veg, and even her grandma grows them. So yeah, maybe now that you're in the sort of German speaking world, you're going to be eating kohlrabi for breakfast.
My one observation actually from Germany is like, why is the food so salty?
Is it?
Every food I've eaten so far, mainly in the canteen of the Opera House, is so salty. But also, like, you buy a packet of crisps and they're so much more salty than they are on the rest of the continent. I think we need to do a European's investigation into salt levels and whether it's just that, like, Germans have a preference for more salty things.
That could well be it. That's interesting. Anne from Austria and other people who seem to know about food in the German-speaking world, please write in and tell us what's going on there. Maybe it's, this is a really stereotype theory, but maybe it's to, like, encourage beer drinking?
Yes, maybe.
There could be some sort of symbiotic relationship. I'm just talking off the top of my head here. Symbiotic relationship between like the beer lobby and the crisp lobby to encourage consumption of both of those goods.
Well, I think that definitely exists, that symbiotic connection. It's at least mutually beneficial, if not evil.
There's something there. Anyway, speaking of beer and crisps, actually not speaking of beer and crisps at all. Where am I going with this?
Speaking of beer and crisps, actually nothing to do with beer and crisps. We are going to be talking to Anna Beate Hovind, the project director of a rather magical piece of public art in Norway, the Future Library. Now, you may have heard about it this week because they announced the latest author, but I don't want to give too much away. Wait until the interview.
Let's save it up. What should we do first?
I don't know. Good week, bad week?
It feels like we should, doesn't it?
Good week, bad week.
Since we started this podcast about 10 months ago, we keep coming back to Poland, where their National Conservative government have pretty regularly caught our attention with some eye-catching policies, almost always leading to bad week. But this time, we are giving good week to Poland. And this is because of the fact that, according to a great article from Deutsche Welle on this topic, there is a rather surprising wind energy revolution afoot in Poland. Yay. The country is pretty coal dependent and the government has been pretty staunchly pro-coal in their rhetoric, but things are looking up after the upper house in Poland passed a new clean energy bill, which makes it more likely that they will meet the EU renewable targets, although it's still going to be quite tricky. Some analysts are suggesting that this will lead to a renewable energy revolution in the surrounding Baltic states as well. We'll see.
Oh, this is really interesting because green energy is not something I tend to associate with Poland, particularly after, did you see that story that was quite big in the British press a few months ago about something called the trash mafia?
No.
So basically, these criminals were getting paid to import British waste for recycling, but then they were just dumping it or burning it.
Oh, that's really sad.
Yeah, terrible. But this is really good development. And, dare I say it, a successful exercise in nation branding. Go back and listen to last week's episode if you haven't already. Like, think Poland, think renewable energy kind of thing.
Poland are hosting the next round of climate talks in a very coal-based city called Katowice. And they've been under a lot of pressure, the Polish government, to keep pushing coal from the unions. So that's going to be an interesting conference. I mean, when I say interesting, it's probably going to be totally depressing as all these climate conferences are. But at least there's a little bit of good news.
We'll have to get our regular depressing climate correspondent, Patrick Gailey, back on.
To tell us the world's about to end.
Yay! Is it time for Bad Week on that lovely note?
Yes, go for it.
It has been a bad week for street food, and specifically a bad week for lovers of street food who are thinking of visiting Florence, one of the most beautiful cities in Italy, of course, but a city where you could now face a fine of up to €500 if you're caught eating in the street. Before you freak out, it's not a total ban on food. That would be insane. And frankly, against human rights, given how many delicious things Italy has to eat on the street. The ban only applies to 4 streets in the city centre, which are really, really congested. And it's only going to apply during peak lunch and dinner times. Basically, these streets have become completely unbearable because they're so packed with tourists that the crowds that form around the sandwich places and the snack places mean you literally can't get down the street anymore. And there's rubbish everywhere. And it's pretty horrible. So the thinking is, if you ban people from eating on these 4 streets during those peak hours, you might help to make it cleaner, but also kind of a nicer place to walk around in general. It's just an experiment. They're doing it for 4 months to see if it works. And it's also not clear how successful they're going to be at policing this thing. Apparently, they're just going to use volunteers to collect the fines, which I think is kind of an amazing thing to volunteer for, like going up to people and fining them for eating sandwiches.
Oh my God, I'd be so annoyed if someone fined me for eating my sandwich in public, because I'm sometimes, actually, I've got something to admit, I'm sometimes a bit of an eater and walker.
Oh no, you would not be welcome in France. I know you're singing in French at the moment, but that's not okay, man.
Why?
Food is one of the basic pleasures in life. You shouldn't do it while running along like it's, you know, the equivalent of a chore to get done, like sending a text message or something. I'm becoming French, aren't I?
Yeah, but sometimes I don't have time. And if I don't have time, I need to eat still.
That's sad. Well, don't do it in Florence then.
Okay.
I just thought it was interesting because it chimes in with this growing trend of cities around Europe that are getting absolutely sick of tourists and saying that we can't cope anymore, which is something that you know all about, I think, being an Amsterdammer.
It is something I know all about. And I feel like we mention it every week now, the fact that Amsterdammers hate tourists so much.
do you think the listeners have got the message yet?
Yeah, I think perhaps they have. Don't come to Amsterdam.
So welcoming. From crowded places to somewhere that is blissfully empty, we are going to the forests outside Oslo in Norway, where it is beautifully calm and quiet. Imagine that you wrote a novel, Dominic.
Okay, I'm imagining. I'm breaking out into hives already.
I know you've already got a podcast, but imagine you somehow found the time to eat while you're running down the street and sing in a new opera and write a novel as well. And now imagine that I told you no one was going to read this novel for 100 years. And that in 100 years, we were going to print it on the wood from these Norwegian trees that we've been growing in the beautiful forest outside Oslo. How would you feel about that? And what kind of book would you write?
I'd kind of feel like, oh, well, no one's going to be alive that I know when they read this. So it doesn't have to be that good. It doesn't have to be my best work.
You wouldn't use your best stuff on it.
No, you'd want to save that for something that actually people are going to read while you're still alive.
Aww.
But then that's really a sad way of doing it. And I'm sure that's not what the authors are doing who are involved with the project.
Absolutely not. So this is a really cool project by the Scottish artist Katie Patterson. And what she has done since 2014 is she's got a bunch of the world's best authors to write novels. She's growing this forest in Norway. And the idea is that the books are being kept safe in at the Deichman Library in Oslo.
Which hasn't been built yet.
Oh, it hasn't been built yet. So where are the books?
I don't know for now, but they're building a library which is going to be completed next year with a special room where the books are going to be kept closed firmly.
Okay. And then they're going to be revealed in 2114.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. Some amazing authors have contributed to this project. Margaret Atwood, David Mitchell, Elif Shafak, and Chion from Iceland. And this week, the South Korean author Han Kang was chosen as the next person to write a novel for people 100 years in the future.
Do you think there's any chance that this is like one big prank?
What do you mean?
I mean, no one can see the books. So that the authors are in on the secret and have been told they don't actually have to write anything. This is just a thought experiment.
Does a book exist in a forest if no one can hear it sit there?
Oh,
that's rubbish. I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, the woman who has made a lot of this happen, along with the artist herself, of course, is Anna Beata Horvid. She is the kind of project manager of all of this.
Anna Beata actually works for a property developer. She's got like what sounds like one of the best jobs in the world. She gets to commission public art or art in public space for this big regeneration project, which is an old docks in Oslo. So one of these projects is this amazing future library.
It is. She's actually not in Oslo right now. She is very far north of the Arctic Circle.
Please excuse the kind of slightly less than perfect audio quality. We want to speak to everyone all across the continent, and sometimes that means that we're speaking to people who are north of the Arctic Circle in Norway, where apparently the 4G connection isn't quite as good as you would hope. But we still really wanted to speak to her, and she has some great things to say.
We are obviously here to talk about this amazing project, the Future Library. But your background is in the business world, I think, and you've worked quite a bit in construction and things like that. How did you find yourself getting involved in this strange and wonderful project?
I'm commissioning the work. So I work on behalf of the property developers in this transformation of the harbour in Oslo. And we build the public spaces and the infrastructure. When you build public spaces, you also often commission art. So that's my role. It's been from the very beginning. We wanted artworks that would be different than sculptures, you know, ordinary sculptures. We wanted to involve artists that work differently and involve people. And but it was actually a blind date with Katie. I knew our work, but this work is also very different from a lot of other of her works, you know, since it's, I don't think she's ever done anything for 100 years, for instance. It was a big surprise when she proposed the work. Maybe you can imagine what my face looked like the day she proposed an artwork that would last for 100 years. How is that going to happen, you know? And also to grow a forest in the middle of a big construction site. I couldn't imagine how to solve it. A lot of things with this project kind of felt impossible in the beginning, but then at the same time, since we now know that it really happened, it learned me how to expand my kind of understanding of the city, or my life, my mortality. It's amazing, actually. It's life-changing, in a way.
Yeah, I find it an incredibly thought-provoking project. I was just wondering, what kind of future planning are you doing? There must be certain steps you have to take to try and ensure that this project will be able to continue over the next 100 years. How much do you think about that, and how much are you actually just working on the minutiae of day-to-day things?
At first, I thought about it all the time, you know, but then since it's lasting for 100 years, you kind of have to learn how to let go. And that comes for both me and the artist. You know, in the beginning, you're thinking you will make sure this will live through, but then you realize, well, I'm going to be dead, actually. And the artist had the same kind of process, understanding that, well, I'm going to be dead. So, of course, I made a trust that will stay and will look after the artwork for 100 years. But then, for me personally, it's I'm asked, how can I be sure that it will happen? And it's this strange feeling of just having to answer. It's all about trust. I have to trust the coming generation to fulfill it and to make it happen and print the manuscripts.
And as for the authors themselves, how hard is it to convince an author to write a book that no one's going to read for 100 years?
At first, before we approached the first author, and I guess you know it's Margaret Atwood, we were quite terrified, you know, because like you said, why should they take part of a project that and nobody will read their manuscript while they're alive? Mm-hmm. And amazingly, that was nothing to worry about. Margaret afterwards, she accepted our invitation really fast. And we were amazed. And I was so happy because at that moment, when she, as the first author, accepted our invitation, I realized that this work is going to happen. So that was one thing. Then we understood that author actually wants to come on board at the same time, they all kind of answered in different ways these questions. But I know that, for instance, Margaret Atwood and David Mitchell and Sean, they're happy there will be no critics.
Yeah.
They can write whatever they want. So it's actually a relief that it won't be read.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it was you writing a novel, do you think you would be more, I don't know, maybe more honest or maybe more brave in what you wrote because you knew no one was going to read it while you were alive?
Yeah, I think this will, we have to wait and see how they solve this. But that makes me think of something else because people keep asking me that if I'm not sad that I won't read the manuscripts because I won't read any of them. You won't either. We will all be dead. But actually, the process, the beauty of the process itself, to be part of this happening, to walk to the forest every year with the authors, I have to admit that that makes so much sense to me and it's so meaningful. So the process itself and the rituals are also extremely nice and it slows me down and it makes my life easy to understand in a way. So for me, the process is maybe as beautiful as the end of it. I'm sure the people that will be able to read the work, I imagine they will be quite sorry that it's an end, if you understand.
How long will you continue choosing an author a year?
Hong Kong will hand it over in May, and then we have 95 more authors and years to come. I want to bring in Stephen Hawking, actually, because I read an article about his cathedral thinking. And some has written an article about Future Library being a cathedral thinking project, and we would want to need more of these kind of cathedral thinking projects.
What exactly do you mean by cathedral thinking?
Cathedral thinking is, I didn't come up with that word, but it's for me, it was Stephen Hawking, and he said that a future now is not about inheriting money or property or a watch or anything. It's about inheriting a project that are based on cathedral thinking, which means you start a project now for the next generation to fulfill.
Well, I mean, I think it sounds incredibly beautiful, this project. And even from a distance, as you say, it can be so effective even without seeing the forest itself. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Anna Beata, today. And Katie will edit this together so that it sounds like we had absolutely no technical problems. This week is another potentially controversial happy ending, but I was almost convinced on Twitter by a fellow podcaster, Joe Bauer, that the trouble that's been bubbling away in Chemnitz for the last few weeks has a happy ending. Now, if you haven't been following this story, frankly, I don't blame you. It's a pretty grim story, another story about resurgent far right from across the continent, and sometimes it can just be rather overwhelming and easier to ignore it. Anyway, but to give you a quick lowdown, a 35-year-old man known as Daniel H. was brutally murdered in Chemnitz, a city in the east of Germany, a few weeks ago, allegedly by two asylum seekers. This sparked protests by the far right, with reports of some protesters performing Nazi salutes and, yeah, a huge catalogue of other depressing reports, including video footage of some immigrants being chased away by the protesters. There were big anti-fascist counter-protests, and there were some pretty tense moments between the two groups of protesters. However, there is a glimmer of a happy ending. Perhaps not the happy endings that we read about in the fairy tales, but, well, something that warms the heart. A concert was organised in response to the protests under the banner hashtag Wir sind mehr, meaning we are more, or there are more of us. The organisers didn't see it as a festival or a party, but they wanted to show solidarity with all those who have been attacked by neo-Nazis. They began the concert with a one-minute silence for the murder victim Daniel H, and went on to have performances from musicians from across Germany, including a relatively famous German punk band called Die Totenhosen. Do you know of them, Katie?
Yeah, I'm an expert on German punk. We've been through this.
Of course you are. But I will finish this happy ending with Joe's tweet to me where he was convincing, because he does quite a good job. He said, 65,000 Germans came out from across the country to support the cause against far-right extremism, blowing estimates out of the water, and it included a local headlining band. Reeks of happy ending to me.
Oh, reeking of happy ending is a little worrying. But yeah, I think we can all agree that we've seen some horrendous things on the streets of Chemnitz in recent days. But seeing 60-ish thousand people rallying against hate, that's an incredible thing to see. And that's, it gives me a lot of hope.
Yay, well done, Chemnitz.
So we're going to play you out, I think, with a bit of the concert, Die Totenhosen, a great punk band from Düsseldorf. But before that, do you want to tell us how people can find us on the interwebs?
Okay, they can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod. Email us, europeanspodcast@gmail.com, Instagram, Europeans Podcast, and on Facebook you just type the Europeans Podcast in and I think it comes up.
Brilliant. So I've got to go and finish my painting now, and you've got to go and learn your words, so we should go.
I keep thinking that when you say you're painting, you're actually like doing oil paintings. I'm imagining you doing a big oil painting version of our Macron logo,
Bob Ross style, just painting a massive sort of screaming Macron face.
Bob Ross, oh, I love Bob Ross,
he's so great. Oh, sleeping tip of the week, everyone, just fall asleep to Bob Ross on YouTube and you will have the most blissful positive dreams about painting and being really good at it and him encouraging you. It's just so lovely. Anyway, on that lovely note, have a great week, Europe. We hope that it is worthy of a novel that isn't going to be read for 100 years, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Cheers.
Cheers.